Yes, we were discussing one of the great miracles in Tanakh, and that is Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, with the three great tzaddikim that were thrown into the fiery furnace because they refused to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar. And there was a great miracle that the furnace lifted itself up from the ground and it became transparent, and everybody saw they were miraculously saved in the fire. And even Nebuchadnezzar was so inspired that he was saying psalms of praise to God. And it said if the Malach wouldn't have shut him up by slapping his face, he would have been greater than David HaMelech in terms of his Tehillim and the like. So we now have a lot of Agadata on those people, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And that is Omer Rav Tanchum Bar Chanilai. Rav Tanchum Bar Chanilai says, B'shah sheyatzu Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah mekiv shen o'esh, when they emerged from the fiery furnace, Bo kol umo sa'olam v'tavchil l'shenem shel Yisrael al p'neim. They went and they slapped. Now here's a very important thing that would certainly confuse you unless you're familiar with this. Literally it says, they went and they slapped the enemies of Israel. But you have to understand that often Chazal use euphemistic language. When they refer to something bad happening to the Jewish people, they don't want to say something bad happened to the Jewish people. They'll say something bad happened to the enemies of the Jewish people. But they really mean the Jewish people. And you'll see from the context that the nations of the world went to the Jews and slapped them around. And they said the following. Yesh lachem eloka kazeh. You have a God who does such miracles. And you're worshiping our idols? Because Yumas Olam basically looked at the Jewish people with disgust. With a God like that, what are you fooling around with our stuff? Miyad, Pasku, and what the people said was a Pasuk that appears in Daniel, Lacha Hashem Hatzdaka, to you Hashem is charity, Volanu Boshes Hapanim, and we have shame and humiliation. And that's exactly right. The reaction of the Jewish people was embarrassment. How could we have been nifshal? Because remember, most of the Jews bowed down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. It was only Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were the only three who didn't. And this is a source of great embarrassment. By the way, if you have a very, very good memory, you will know that this is the first verse that we recite in the Slichos before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Lecha Hashem, after Ashrei, Lecha Hashem Hatzdaka, Volanu Boshes Hapanim. Okay. Now then the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Amar Rav Yainasan, Mai Tichsiv, what is the meaning of the Pasuk in Shir Hashirim? Amarti Ele B'Tamar, O Chaza B'San Sinav. Again, Shir Hashirim, you'll recall, is written as a mashal of a shepherd and a princess that have a loving relationship together. So the man says, I thought I would climb the tamar. Tamar is a date tree, date palm, and I will grab its branches, meaning it's kind of an image. He wants to get into her palace. So what is the interpretation? Because according to our allegorical interpretation, the loving man is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the princess is Am Yisrael. So what does it mean Hashem says, I wanted to climb the tree? What tree does Hashem want to climb? So Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani Amarti Ele B'Tamar. I thought I would be elevated by the whole palm tree, because the Jewish people are compared to a palm tree. But unfortunately, all I have is a branch. That's what he said. I thought Ela B'Tamar. Now Ochaza B'San Sinav. I only have a little branch. Hananya Mishael V'Azariah. Okay. 1 second. Yeah. And Omer Rav Yochanan, my Dichsiv. There's a pasuk that says Ra'isi Halayla. Okay, let me give a little background to this, because sometimes in Agadata, sometimes it's hard to get a perspective because we seem to be just bringing verses in at random from different books and interpreting them. This is a pasuk from Zechariah. Now you have to know a little bit about prophecy. Prophecy is a special gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Am Yisrael, And it's a very intimate way of connecting to Hashem. Not everybody was a prophet. On the other hand, there were schools of prophecy. Because we read in the book of Malachim that there were B'nai HaNeviim, which literally means the sons of Neviim, but it actually means the disciples of the Neviim. Now, what did you do in prophecy school? What courses did you take? In fact, somebody tried to open one in Tel Aviv. I think there may still be one, but that's not authentic. But there actually is a prophecy school now, but not real. But there used to be a real prophecy school. So what do you do with a real prophecy? Like, what would you learn? Well, it would be heavy Kabbalah, so to speak. But basically, besides regular Torah, there would be, Aryeh Kaplan writes, would be meditative techniques, being able to focus your consciousness. Now, because prophecy is a gift, even if you formally do all the meditation and all of the thought processing, you don't automatically get it. Maybe it's only 1 out of 1,000. Maybe it's only 1 out of 1,000,000. But you need to go through that process. Because there was only one prophet in the world who just communicated to Hashem without any advanced preparation, that was Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu could talk to God whenever he wanted. Other prophets had to prepare themselves with meditation, and they would often go into a dreamlike trance. Not necessarily asleep, but it's kind of, they became immobilized. They became into a very deep trance, and their nevuos were dreamlike. Moshe Rabbeinu could literally be having a cup of coffee and talking to Hashem. He didn't need to escape his body. He didn't need to go into a trance or whatever it is. Now, this is Nevuah. And, of course, you also have to be a tzaddik. Bilam is the one exception because Hashem gave the non-Jews great prophets, so they shouldn't claim if you would have given us somebody like Moshe. By the way, I just want to ask you a little kasha on that. This is a famous teaching that Rashi brings, that Bilam was as great as prophet as Moshe Rabbeinu, because otherwise the nations of the world would say, if you only gave us such a great prophet like Moshe, we too would be righteous. So Hashem gave them Bilam, and they didn't become righteous. So let me ask you the obvious question. Well, he gave them Bilam, he didn't give them Moshe. What's the shot? They can still say, if you would have given us a righteous prophet. So you know what the Mefarshim say? They say an amazing thing. They say, Bilam was not always an evil person. Bilam became evil as a result of the prophecy that he got. Meaning to say, you have two people, Moshe and Bilam. They are the same. One gets prophecy and remains or becomes such a great tzaddik. Because here you have to understand, prophecy at some level is power. It's kind of a power to talk to God. It's a power to do miracles. Right? And power can corrupt a person. So, the Goyim don't have an excuse. Hey, if you would have given us a tzaddik. Hashem gave them someone who in his raw material was as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. The prophecy ruined him because the power ruined him. Right? That's the idea of power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. But not that he had absolute power, but the more power we have, the more corrupted we are. Right? So this is Nevuah. The Kuzari writes that Nevuah only exists in the land of Israel. Until, well, in the Midbar it existed, until we got to Eretz Israel. But once we got to Eretz Israel, Nevuah only exists in Eretz Israel because of the holiness of the land. Now, Nevuah lasted from, you know, the beginning until the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Right? We had the first Beis HaMikdash, it was destroyed by the Babylonians. We have 70 years of exile. Then we return. The last Nevi'im in Tanakh are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. These are the last Nevi'im of Tanakh, and they were the Nevi'im that commanded us to build the second Beis HaMikdash. Right? After that, no Nevuah. The whole Bayis Sheni, there was no Nevuah. That's why there was no Urim V'Tumim. The Kohen had a breastplate, but there was no prophetic responses from the letters that lit up in the breastplate, because Urim V'Tumim is a form of Nevuah. And the like. Ad Kidei Kach, the Gemara says that there are Nevuahs today, but the only people that have Nevuah are deranged people and little children. You're 10, you're not a little child anymore, but maybe if you have a 2-year-old brother or something, he might be a Navi or the like. Why is that? Because Hashem will intersperse in people who babble, so to speak, little kernels of truth, but you're not going to be able to tell the difference. What's Nevuah and what's falsity. Now, Rashi then goes on and says that as we are getting closer and closer to the end of Nevuah, the signals from Shemayim get more and more garbled. They're less clear. And that's why Rashi says the Nevuahs of Zechariah, who is really the last prophet, he and Malachi, is a very obscure Nevuah. It's like looking at an old television picture which has all sorts of, the picture is not clear. I don't know if that's a problem today, but when I was growing up, you had the old television tubes, and you also had all sorts of snow on the screen and stripes and everything else. And ad kidei kach, and this is very interesting, sometimes the prophet himself doesn't understand his own nevuah. He sees pictures and images, but he doesn't fully understand. Sometimes he understands it in stages. And that's why, by the way, when you learn Nach, it's interesting, it's a little frustrating, but it's important to do this. We learn Nach and we learn an obscure prophecy, we immediately want to know what it is, so we look in Rashi, and Rashi will often interpret what this means in light of the next Perek. And that's good, but what's helpful to understand is, when the Navi got the first Perek, the Navi didn't yet have the second Perek. So it's helpful to kind of put yourself in the position of the Navi, in which if I don't understand Perek Aleph until Perek Beis, the Navi didn't understand Perek Aleph until Perek Beis. It's not like the Navi understood everything at the beginning. Prophecies often unfold. So be it as it may, Zechariah does have a distinction, although there are other Nevuahs that are up here as well, as being, I think, the only Nevuah where Rashi specifically says, almost Rashi throws up his hands, and he says, the prophecies of Zechariah are sasumim ma'od. They are very mysterious. And once again, the idea is, because towards the end of Kavyochol, Hashem is getting further and further away from us, our ability to access it. Right? So he's not yet beyond reception. But the reception is not clear at this point. So this is one of the Nevuahs of Zechariah. Now, vis-a-vis Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, just remember our chronology, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are towards the beginning of the 70 years, right after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Zechariah is towards the end of the 7 years when they're building the second Mikdash. So a number of years have passed. So here's going to be a good example of a very obscure Nevuah of Zechariah. A great graphic, so to speak. It says, Ra'isi alayla, I saw in the night, V'hine ish rochev al sus adam, I saw a man riding on a red horse. Now a red horse, just like Para Aduma, again, people sometimes make a mistake. They think the Para Aduma has to look like a fire truck. That's not true. Adam in the Torah does not have to be bright red, but rather, brown. Right? And in fact, the color of a Para Aduma is not uncommon for cows. Many, many cows, many calves are brown. The Chiddush of Para Aduma is that there can't be, any other color there, and that might be hard to get. But the actual color of a Para Aduma is not uncommon. Did I mention that there's a Para Aduma in growing up in America right now, that some farm has it? And they contacted the Temple Institute here in Jerusalem to be sure they're following the halachos, not to make it puzzle. Because if you put a weight on it, if you put a yoke on it, no good. If it cohabits with a female, no good. So you kind of have to be very, very careful how you handle it. They're going to send, they check on the hairs, but of course that could change. Now, there is a big problem with Para Aduma, and that is, nobody can be Tahor until they're sprinkled with the ashes of the Para Aduma. Okay, that's fine. On the other hand, the only people who are kosher to make the Para Aduma, to prepare the ashes, are people already Tahor. So the problem is, until you have a Para Aduma of ashes, how do you, how do you become Tahor? You see, the way it worked in the olden days was that when you were running low on your old Para Aduma, you would be able to sprinkle 5 or 10 people who would then be pure, who would be able to make the new Para Aduma, shechting it and burning it, because you had an inventory of old ashes that could be metaher people to make a new one. But here we have a problem that nobody's Tohar today, because we've all been in cemeteries or whatever, and we can't make a paraduma because we don't have an old inventory to make us Tohar. And besides that, who's going to sprinkle it on us? Because you have to have a Torah person to sprinkle on us. So the truth of the matter is, even with our paraduma, there's nothing we can do with it. So you may ask, how will this ever be resolved? The answer is that before Mashiach comes, Eliyahu HaNavi, who never died, will come back, and he will come back with a canister that contains the remnants of the last paraduma. Since Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen, he's Pinchas, the Kohen, he is kosher to sprinkle those ashes on a small number of people who will then become Tohor, and they will be able to make a new paraduma that could then purify all of Am Yisrael. But the missing link, again?
What if we use robots?
You can't. I mean, basically, the Torah dictates who has to do this particular work, and an automated procedure would not be kosher. Yeah.
If the person is going to become common, how do you sprinkle more than one person without becoming common after sprinkling person?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's a very good question. People raise the problem of what statisticians call infinite regression. You know, everybody. But the answer is this. Here's the way you break the problem. The tuma of handling the paraduma is not a tuma that requires paraduma to be pure from. Meaning, if I handle the ashes, I am only tameh for one day, I go to the mikveh, and by nightfall I'm fine. So yeah, you see, you're correct. The guys that are actually doing it will be tameh for one day, but they'll be okay afterwards. And the tumor that they get from handling the ashes does not disqualify them from handling the ashes, because that's part of the job. It's only when you have a tumor from some other source that you're... Did you want to say something?
Yes. I was wondering what a tumor was.
Okay, so the word tumor is impurity, and it's not a hygienic idea. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're dirty or something, but it's a spiritual idea that when you're in contact with death, since death is a reminder of the sin of Adam and Eve, because the Adam and Eve would have lived forever, and because they rebelled against Hashem, God made death into the world. So whenever I touch a dead body or I walk into a cemetery, I am impure, meaning I'm not allowed to enter the temple, I'm not allowed to bring sacrifices, because I have to be pure to be able to enter. Now, today we don't have a temple. The sacred temple of Jerusalem, yes. Right? So for most of us, being tamei is not a problem, so to speak. We learn, we daven, we live a regular life. But when there's a temple and when Mashiach comes, you have to be very, very careful, either not to become tamei, or if you did become tamei, to be purified with the ashes of the red heifer that's thrown upon you. Right, that's the idea of ashes. This is a red cow, not a red cow, it's a male. No, it's a female, para. It's a red cow called a heifer, and it's slaughtered, and it's burned into ashes, and the ashes are mixed with spring water from the spring, and when I'm tamei, because I went into a cemetery, so on the third day from my cemetery visit, and on the seventh day, I get sprinkled with a little water and ashes, and then I have to go to a mikveh, and then I become pure again. Right? So there's a seven-day getting pure.
So yeah. So in modern day, if I visit a family member's grave or something, I can still go to synagogue.
That's 100% correct. It is a very good question. That's right. It is true that when you visit somebody's grave, you become tamei, but for most purposes, it makes no difference. Now, the only group of people that it makes a difference for is a Kohen. A Kohen, as you probably know, is not allowed to go into a cemetery. So he's not allowed to, except even the Kohen at the funeral of his closest relatives. He could go to the funeral, but he could not. A Kohen could not visit the grave of his father on an annual basis. He's allowed to go to the funeral of his father, but he doesn't. That's why in most religious cemeteries, they actually bury Kohanim next to the outer fence of the cemetery, so the Kohen could visit a grave standing outside of the cemetery fence. That's where they position it. Who is a Kohen? A Kohen is a descendant of Aaron. We're called the priest, right? You know, we have... Now, when there's going to be a Beis HaMikdash, they're going to do all the sacrifices. Today, they have a few honors. They get called up to the Torah first. right? The rest of us common people are second, third, fourth. And the other thing is that, are you familiar with Kohanim blessing the people? Have you ever seen them? Okay, well, it's really very interesting. In America, they only do it on holidays, but here in Jerusalem, the Kohanim get up and they pronounce a blessing on people every single day. So you come to Israel and you can hear this, you can get blessed every day. So that's a good thing. Or Sephardic, anyway. I don't want to discourage Aliyah, but you're right. You can do it in America with Sephardim too. Okay, yeah. So anyway, so we have a prophecy here where a man is riding on a red horse, very strange, which means a brownish horse. For who omeid Allah ben Hadassim? Remember, this is a dream or a vision Zechariah is having. And this man on a red horse is riding among the Hadassim. Hadassim are the myrtles, like we have on Sukkot. V'yacharav, and afterwards, I see other horses, Susim Adumim, red horses, Sarukim, striped horses, meaning different hues, Ulavanim, and white horses. So he has this image of wild horses, like riding around. Some people are riding them and some of them don't have riders. So first of all, what is the initial phrase, I see the night? Because grammatically it's a little strange. It should have said in Hebrew, Ra'isi Balayla, I saw in the night these horses. But it doesn't say the bays. Ra'isi Halayla, I saw the night. Well, what did he see? Just the night? What does that mean? So the Gemara says the following. This is a reference. He is having a vision of what Hashem wanted to do after Hananya, Mishael, Azariah. Bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu lahapoch es kol ha'olam kulo lalayla. Because of the idolatry of the Jewish people, the sins of the Jewish people, Hashem wanted to turn this whole world into total darkness. Meaning, Reisi, I saw the night that Hashem wanted to bring on this world. And that is the meaning of the man that is riding on the horse. Who is the man? The man is actually a reference to God, as we find in Oz Yashir. Hashem is called a man of war. Now, this already gets you into very, very thin ice and difficult ideas here. Because it is true that in the Torah, Hashem is called a man of war. But he's called a man of war only because he's a warrior. He fights against the evil, not because he has the appearance of a man. Now, we believe, of course, Hashem has no body. And yet, we are describing a graphical image that this Navi saw of a man riding on a horse, in which the Agadah says, the Ish is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it says, Hashem Ish Milchama. So, what does that mean? He saw, the Navi Zechariah saw, a physical image of God? Now, all I can tell you is, in the book of Yechezkel, another Navi of that period, there's also a description of the divine throne in heaven. And it says, and on that throne I saw the image of a man. Rashi comments laconically, I don't have permission to explain this pasuk. He says, so I would borrow from Rashi and basically say the same idea here, and that is, sometimes in prophecy, see, what prophecy does is, even with, and let me give you a less drastic example, maybe it's easier to understand, because this is an extreme example. You know, angels are always pictured as human-like creatures. That Avram sees angels, right? But in reality, angels are not human-like creatures. If you were to be transported in Shemayim, angels are like energy forces. They're pure spirit. They're not a body. But what happens is, since I as a human being can only perceive and communicate with bodies, the angels in my mind get processed into bodies in order to permit me to interact with them. Which means, in prophecy as well, prophecy is a pure spiritual message that the brain and the imagination turn into visual images. Now, in the case of angels, that's not so difficult to understand. But sometimes it turns into even the Ribbono Shel Olam, meaning to say that the Ribbono Shel Olam sometimes allows himself to be pictured in human form, in a Mara of Nevuah, not because that's God's essence. God's essence, Chas V'Shalom, is totally not corporeal, but it's a way of the Navi being able to accept the prophecy and be able to visualize it. So this is the man that is riding on the horse. And why is it a red horse? Because what is the word for red? Adom. And Adom is the same word, same sound at least, as dumb, blood. Hashem wanted to destroy the world and spill blood. And why didn't he do it? But when he looked at the righteous people who were willing to give their life, even if they were thrown into a furnace, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Niskara Radaito, God was appeased. Now, where do you get that? You get that from the phrase, he was standing among the Hadassim, the myrtle. Now, on Sukkot, when we take the Hadassim as part of our Lulav and Esrog, how many Hadassim do we take?
Three.
Two Arevos, three Hadassim. So the drash of the Gemara for Zechariah's prophecy is, see how each element is given a definition. There, right? I saw the night, and a man was riding on a red horse, and he is between the Hadassim. So look how each element is now explicated. It was night. Hashem wanted to turn the universe into darkness. The man, which is Hashem, the man of war, is riding on a red horse. Red is dam. And the thing that stopped Hashem was he encounters the Hadassim, the myrtle. Those are the three tzaddikim, because there are three Hadassim, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and that is why he stopped doing what he was doing. Because the word omed, which means stand, also means to stand still, meaning the image is Hashem is riding this war horse, and he stands still when he encounters the Hadassim. So what Zechariah is being told is a pretty powerful idea, that when all the Jewish people were bowing down to the idols in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, Hashem wanted to destroy the world. And it was only because of those three tzaddikim that the world was not destroyed. Now, the question I have, again, this is a beautiful interpretation of the drasha, of the Nevuah. What's not entirely clear to me is, what is the point of Zechariah getting this vision? I mean, basically, by the time Zechariah is around, this had happened a long time ago. This had happened like 50, 60 years before. Why, in other words, of what particular relevance is this information for Zechariah? But I think the message is that we're about to rebuild the second temple. And the first temple was destroyed because of idolatry and those other sins. So Zechariah needs to communicate to Am Yisrael the idea that the Avodah Zarah of Am Yisrael didn't only result in a golus, but Chas V'Shalom, it could have resulted in literally the destruction of the world. So the message to Am Yisrael is, you know, better be careful, because next time maybe you're not going to have a Hananiah, Mishael, Vazaria around to be able to save you.
How does that work with Sodom needing 10 people for not to be destroyed?
Why would three be enough here?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. That is an interesting question. In fact, Rashi points out that even when you had eight in the time of Noah, that did not save the world from being stripped. Yeah, that is a good question. But I think our answer would have to be that there probably were. First of all, I can mention at least one other Jew that for sure did not bow down to the idol. That's Daniel. So there probably were more than 10 people who didn't bow down to the idol.
Mm-hmm.
But because Am Yisrael has a special relationship to God, God is stricter with the Jewish people, so 10 people wouldn't be enough. The greatness of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah is not simply they didn't sin. There might be others who didn't sin, but they were willing to give their life for Kiddush Hashem. And, that, mm-hmm. and they were the ones that were thrown into the furnace.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Although I will tell you, the Gemara in Ksubos does make a remarkable statement. It says, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were willing to die, but if Nebuchadnezzar would have tortured them, they would have broken down. The Gemara says it. Now the question that raises is, does that mean you're allowed to break down, or you just would have broken down? Meaning, according to Halacha, that's an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. But I have to give up my life before I worship an idol. Do I have to submit to torture? That's the question. Meaning, does the Gemara mean they just would have broken down, or does the Gemara mean halachically, because torture could be worse than death? Obviously, it can be worse than death. Death happens. Torture could go on and on and on and on and on. And there is at least a halachic question, whether the obligations of giving up your life includes submitting to repeated torture. That's a machlokas. Yeah.
But torture, I don't really get why we need all of the punishments listed or the torture and all of that if we worship idols. Because, in my opinion,
yeah.
we don't really need to, it would definitely be very unfortunate if we found it necessary to get in the it.
Well, you know, God doesn't want you to live a life of falsity. God doesn't want you to live a lie. You know, the idols have no power. They're not real. They're just statues. And when you turn to the idols, you know, you're living a life of lying. And sometimes God says it is better to die than to live a life of such falsity. And that's why the Jewish law says that I have to give up my life before I worship an idol. But I am raising the question that perhaps God would give you an out if there's extreme torture. There is a famous, by the way, response of the Rambam. The Rambam lived in Islamic countries, obviously. The Rambam lived in Egypt. Apparently there was a time where Muslims were running around just stopping Jews at random in the street and making them say whatever their three lines are. There's one God and he's Allah, Muhammad is his prophet, etc. And otherwise they would just slit their throat. So is a Jew allowed to profess that formula to save his life? Or must the Jew have to require that he give up his life? The question is it Avodah Zarah? So the Rambam writes in a Tshuva that although asserting Muhammad is a prophet is a denial of a fundamental principle of faith, that Moses is the greatest prophet, but Islam is not idolatry. Islam is a monotheistic religion. So the Rambam writes in a Tshuva that a Jew would be allowed to profess allegiance to Islam to save his life, even though he would not be allowed to profess allegiance to Christianity. That's the Rambam's psak. On the other hand, in the halachic Mishneh Torah, he does not make that distinction. I mean, he seems to really have to give up your life, so it's not really clear what the Rambam's psak
and
that.
And the torture, there's no miskona in the torture. There's no miskona in the torture.
There's no
resolution in the torture question.
No, I would say there's no clear resolution. Again, we do have the passage in the Gemara, where the Gemara says, had Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah been tortured, they would have broken down. But it's not clear, is that a halachic rule, or is that just they would have broken down? People break down, that's not, you know, and we can't judge that. But it may not be the halachic permissibility to break down. Okay. We know Hadassim or Tzadikim, etc. Now what about the other one? Now we have one more part of the prophecy we have to explain. Because it mentions other horses, right? That the man is riding on the red horse, and then you have horses that are red, that are striped, and that are like zebras, so it's a striped horse, and that are white. So the Gemara says very beautifully, this is a graphic sense of the all red turning into reddish stripes, turning into white, which is the sign of mercy, meaning Hashem is riding on this red horse of blood. But after he encounters the Hadassim, It's like the red horses morph into striped horses, and the striped horses morph into white horses, as if to say Hashem's anger diminished and disappeared until there's rachamim. Right? White, we know, red is the sign of din. White is the sign of purity and rachamim.
It's like a carbon, you know? Yeah. String.
That's right. That's on Yom Kippur, right? The red string turned white. Although the Mekubalim say blue is a sign of rachamim. You guys have been to Tzfat, right? So if you go to Tzfat, you'll notice that all of the Kabbalistic shuls, the Ari shul and the Beis Yosef shul, is all like sky blue. There's a lot of blue in the room. It says because blue is a sign of rachamim and mercy. Yeah.
I was thinking, Hashem's anger may be a function of tzimtzum, in the sense that, yes, there's an element of punishment that teaches us, which is a sign of love, ultimately, which is Jewish philosophy. But to punish, from his perspective at least, or to get angry, it doesn't fit with an idea of a perfect, all-encompassing, non-lacking entity. So, the only way, at least I could ever understand how Hashem could be angry, is if that when Tzimtzum happened, that he allowed that space for him to be angry.
Well, that might be one interesting way of describing it. Maimonides gives a simpler explanation, actually. Maimonides says that any description of the Almighty's emotion is simply describing his actions, which, if done by a human actor, would be indicative of emotion. So if God brings a calamity, right? So if a human being were to do that, we would say, oh, he must be very angry. So God is dispassionate, so to speak. God is not moved by emotion. God is moved by whatever is necessary to carry out his will. And we use emotions as labels to be put on actions that are indicative of emotions. In fact, this is the famous teaching of Maimonides that philosophers call the doctrine of negative attributes. the Rambam learns that the only thing we can say about Hashem is what he is not. We cannot say anything about what he is. I can say he's not physical, he's not many, he's not emotional. In other words, I could look at myself and say, he's not anything I am. That's all you can say. But you can't actually describe what he is, because the finite cannot perceive the infinite. You may have come across, maybe in college or whatever, a book that was very popular in the 19th century. They sometimes bring it up in physics courses, called Flatlands. It's actually famous.
With the triangle.
Right. It's a relatively famous novel, at least in recent years. I think it's gotten a bit more well known. This involved a universe or a world where the human beings were living in a two-dimensional universe. It's hard for us to even picture. They were just like flat. And the book describes their encounter with a three-dimensional figure. And how they just couldn't interpret it. They interpreted it in different ways to make it consistent with the two dimension. And everything they said was wrong, but based on the way they perceived reality, they had to look at it that way. Well, modern physicists, string theory, says instead of just being three dimensions or four dimensions, time, space, time, there might be 10 dimensions, there might be 26. Okay, 10 is interesting, the 10 spheros, 26 dimensions. Is the gematria of Yudke Vavke, and these dimensions are compacted and hidden, and we don't even know what this means. You talk to a physicist, he sounds like he's a Makobo today. All sorts of things. I spoke to a guy who happened to be a physicist. I mentioned that in the Zohar, it talks about on the very first day of creation, God made a light that was hidden in the darkness, and that's even a deeper light than the light that was manifest. So he told me that physicists actually say that there's something called dark light. There is light concealed in darkness, and in the early years of the universe, whenever the Big Bang supposedly occurred, the light was trapped in the darkness. The photons of light were in the darkness. So it's a fascinating thing. The more you delve into the physical structure, you really, really see, on such a deep level, Hashem looked in the Torah and created the world. The physical world mirrors the spiritual complexity of the Torah. So the basic problem is that vis-a-vis God, we're like the flatlanders, meaning to say, I cannot possibly perceive or even describe these other dimensions of reality. So because of this, the Rambam says, I can only know about myself, and then I can say, God isn't whatever I am. So the same thing with emotions. God does not have emotions, because emotions imply a loss of control. I get angry, you know, and I do all sorts of things. Rather, God's anger is willed, so to speak, to express and carry out his will, but it's not an actual emotional response. Okay. So that's the idea of the red horses became striped horses and eventually became white horses. Okay. And the Gemara says, we see from here a practical lesson. Now, here, let me go back to this. Some of you guys may have learned Maseches Brachos. And you may remember the ninth parak of Brachos has a long, long part in the Gemara, like 10 blocks, on dream interpretation. You can write a whole book on Talmudic dream interpretation. You see this, you see that, etc. Now, the truth of the matter is, though, you see in the Gemara that there were different views. One opinion says dreams are nothing. Another opinion says dreams are kind of a prophecy from God, but just as there is no grain without chaff and straw, so there is no dream without all sorts of junk. So our problem is we don't know the difference. And then the Gemara says as well, of course we see in the Torah itself dreams can have a lot of power, like Yosef, that a dream follows however it's interpreted. So the Gemara even gives us a very strange story about a Abaye of a Rebbe, that they had a bunch of dreams, identical dreams, and Rebbe didn't pay the interpreter, and Abaye paid the interpreter. So Abaye kept on getting good interpretations and good things were happening to him, and Rebbe kept on getting, you know, tragedies happening to him over and over and over again because he didn't pay the dream interpreter. It's hard for us to understand what that means, but Chazal clearly do regard dreams as having some significance. That's why Halacha says if you have a bad dream, like a nightmare, if you're able to fast, you actually fast or give tzedakah, or the like. So here, the Gemara says the following. Since we see in the prophecy of Zechariah that a white horse is a sign of mercy, therefore, if in my own dream I dream of a white horse, that is a good sign from heaven that Hashem is showing me mercy and compassion. And because again, we learn out from the Nevuah. Okay. Now, the Gemara then asks the following kasha. You know, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, again, we're concerned for the rest of the story here. They were saved with this great miracle. And then they're never mentioned again. What was their life after the miracle? What happened to them? So the Gemara gives you a few views. Some of these views aren't so happy. Rav says, Ayin Hara Mesuf. They died right after they got out of the furnace because of the evil eye. Now this too, see every line here has a whole thing that needs to be discussed. What is the evil eye? You know, you hear this a lot, right? People don't talk about their money, they don't talk about their kids. Sometimes you ask a person, how many children do they have? They won't say. Or when they say, you know, my daughter had a baby, Kainahara, believe, it's just Yiddish, Bali Ayinhara. Ayinhara, evil eye, quite literally, just literally, without explaining it, I'll try to explain a little bit of it, is that somebody looks at you with jealousy and envy, and it's like a magic, you know, ray comes out, and can obliterate. Now, what exactly is that? I mean, there's no magic thing coming out of your eye, the evil eye. So Rav Dessler tries to explain it in kind of a rational way. And that is because, I mean, ultimately it's a mystical way, even with the rational way. Ultimately, because man is made in the image of God, the same way that God's thoughts immediately become realities, so too a human being's thoughts create realities in the world, energies in the world. And when I look askance at somebody, and I'm jealous of them, and of course I'm committing a sin. It's a great sin for me to be jealous. But that doesn't stop the fact that created negative spiritual energy. And that negative spiritual energy can harm a person, because that's kind of the power that God put in. In fact, it's interesting, I heard, you know, the mother of one of the captive boys, the one that's also an American citizen, Naftali Frankel. So the mother seems to be like the spokesperson for the three women, for the three families. She seems to talk the most. So she's Rachel Frankel. So she said that she misses her son tremendously, but she doesn't want to think about it too much. And she didn't say because it gets her sad. She says she didn't want to create the negative energies that might turn into. In other words, what you think might become the reality. Right? You think negatively, you release negative forces. So the notion of thinking positively actually has a significance in Judaism. That's ayin hara. So that's why there is a concept that don't show off your good fortune, you know, be modest, be humble, because you don't want to attract the negative spiritual energies. So it actually says here that these great people who survived the fiery furnace, they died ayin hara because people looked at them. I guess Jews looked at them and said, who do these people think they are? You know, such big tzaddikim and the like. Right? So that is one interpretation of ayin hara. Rabbi Yoshua Omer. Now Rabbi Yoshua says something that's even a bit more strange, and that is, literally it says, Barok Tavu, they drowned in saliva. Well, you know, how much saliva drowned? where are you gonna find saliva of a giant? Like what do you mean drowned in saliva? So Rashi offers us a little bit of a guide here. That is, and you see, by the way, this is the way Agadata speaks. Agadata speaks in this kind of exaggerated language. He's making the point. We learned before that after Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were saved, the nations went to the world and they spat at the Jewish people and said, how dare you worship our gods if you have a God that does these miracles? Right, that's the spit. The spit is the disdain that the nations had for the Jewish people. So it says Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah died in the spit, meaning they died because of that disdain. Now, okay, it's all good. They didn't drown in saliva, but it means they died in the disdain. Why would that be a reason for them to die? Right? Why would that be a reason? So, one second. So apparently we see a fascinating point. It's really hard to understand. In some way, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah caused the world to have less respect for the Jewish people. Paradoxically. Because they looked at the Jewish people and said, you have a God that does this miracle. And you degrade yourself to worship idols. So what does that mean? The nations of the world look down at most of the Jews. So it's interesting. It's really hard to grasp. What it's saying is, if in your righteousness you make other Jews look bad, Hashem holds you. It's kind of an aveira that you are. Now, it's kind of a no-win situation, because if Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah wouldn't have been willing to give their life, Hashem would have destroyed the world. That's the first thing we said. So they did the absolute best thing. But still, there is this idea, the law of unintended consequences, that if your actions caused Am Yisrael to be degraded in the eyes of others, Hashem holds you accountable. You see this in a lot of cases, that sometimes life is a no-win situation, in the sense that even if you do the right thing, if people suffer because of it, Hashem will hold you responsible in some way. I guess the analogy Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to say is, sometimes even if you do the right thing, you're going to get hurt. Let's say, for example, a baby is in a burning house, and you risk your life and you run into the house to save the baby. You did 100% good thing, but you're going to get burnt. Meaning the fact that it's a good thing doesn't mean a miracle is going to happen. Always, some cases a miracle happens, but Bedeir Klal, miracles don't happen. Meaning, there are consequences even to good actions. So it's so strange. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had the zechus, the supernatural zechus, to be saved from a fire. But they didn't have the zechus to be saved from the denigration of Am Yisrael as a result of their actions. So you see, this is an important Rashi, because it takes a statement that would otherwise sound like preposterous. They drowned in spit. They drowned in saliva. And he's offering the interpretation. They drowned because of the saliva, so to speak, that denigrated the Am Yisrael in the eyes of the nations. So we have two views that are not so great. They died from Ayin Hara, or they died because of this. But then we have the Chachamim's view, which is the most optimistic view. They were zocher to come back to Eretz Yisrael, and they were able to get married, and they were able to have children, sons and daughters, which actually means, interestingly enough, that they came back to Eretz Yisrael before the rest of Am Yisrael. Because Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah is the beginning of the 70 years, not the end of the 70 years. So it's interesting to picture that. We try to picture Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They are the first pioneers. They return to a land that is actually bereft of Jews. Okay, because the other Jews didn't come back till after the 70s. So it's interesting that, according to this view, they were chosen to pave the way to rebuild the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, maybe we'll stop here.
Just ask you two questions about the Nevuah.
Yeah.
I've heard it suggested that often when they saw, when the Nevi'im saw things that were far in the future, like if they were to see helicopters or something, they would describe it as insects. Yep. Is that a
absolutely so. Yeah. In one of Yechezkel's Nevuahs, he describes the Messianic War of Gog and Magog, and he describes fire that will melt faces. Now, what does that mean? So many have said that that was a reference to nuclear war, which would have that type of effect.
Nuclear war, no one, if I went up to someone in the times where they created Talmud, thousands of years.
Right.
Before nuclear war,
that's right.
Anyone would even, understand the word.
No, that's correct.
How is there a reference?
No, that's exactly the point. The prophet didn't understand an atom bomb or a hydrogen bomb. All he saw was the effects. In other words, God gave him a picture of the effects of nuclear war, which the prophet didn't understand. He didn't know what it was. In retrospect, we can know what it is. In other words, that's exactly what you're saying. The Navi describes it as a fire, even though it actually means something else. By the way, there's a comment of the Vilna Gaon also that's very scary. The Vilna Gaon writes, I've been looking for this quote, I can't find it, but I've seen it brought down, that the last war before the coming of Mashiach will only be 6 minutes. And people didn't understand 200 years ago what type of war could be fought in 6 minutes. Unfortunately, we now know. So there are a lot of these hints that were literally not understood at the time, that in the course of time. Yeah.
I mean, may I add that you could have also used reference then. It could have just been a negotiation of the price of a taxi. Could have been something like that.
Well, but that wouldn't be a war. That wouldn't be a war, right? It's described as a war, okay? By the way, what is your first name? You didn't get your name.
I'm Beth.
That's okay. Pleasure to meet you. And thank you for asking good questions.
Thank you for answering.
How much of the body of prophecy, I mean, a lot of it seems to refer to things that were going on at the time. How much of the body of prophecy was for, like, our time, future time?
So here's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, in Megillah, there were thousands of prophets who don't have any books. So anything that's in the book of the prophets is because it applies to future times as well. So, but that does mean there's a double meaning to say, the prophecy has an immediate message for the audience it's directed to, and it has a long-term message.
So there is a tad that, that even the prophecy there in Zechariah with the horses would be Negev Bezman Hazeh for something.
Well, I think it is Negev Bezman Hazeh, because the reason it's Negev, it's the same message. It's to remind us that we live in a precarious balance, that, that our chatam are not just, hey, go ahead and sin, God has mercy. We're supposed to remember this idea that the world was very close to being destroyed.
So even if it's
and that's a message that I take in mind now, that, you know, I can't just not care about the averus that are done in the world.
So I mean, even if it's not a direct message about particular events, it has some sort of moralistic.
That's correct. Teaching. That's correct. Meaning the particular event may be a past event, but it's incorporated in Tanakh because it is telling me something that's relevant.
And where would be a good place to look for the relevance of it? Because one is there. I mean, would you get that from Rashi? Would you get
Not always. It is a little bit of a problem actually, because often the Mefarshim Tanakh tend to emphasize individual psukim and not overall themes. Mm. In other words, if you're looking for a thematic commentary on Nach, it's not so easy to find. It's not so easy to find. But there are some books. There are some books written about Yemosa Mashiach that try. Well, the Abarbanel might be a good place to look. The Abarbanel writes very voluminous, very long. The Abarbanel, but the Abarbanel tries to apply it to general themes. But the only problem with the Abarbanel is, see, the Abarbanel lived in the 1400s. In fact, he was the finance minister of Spain when the Jews were expelled in 1492. And the Abarbanel was so convinced that Mashiach would be coming in his time. Okay. So he interprets everything as, oh, the discovery of America. Now, the truth is, it could have been true, because had we been Zohar, it could have been true. But all I'm saying is, you're not going to hear from the Abarbanel how to apply it to the 21st century. But the Abarbanel was applying it to the 15th century thing. But there are some websites. I think a fellow Rabbi Pinchas Winston, I think he teaches it. He's a little bit of a controversial guy, but he tries to apply these nevuas to Bizman Hazeh. It's not an easy thing. And historically, our Mefarshim don't do it that much. Mm. And in fact, the Rambam even discourages it. The Rambam writes, at least messianic prophecies, that to get too involved in the details and to look at current events, right? Christians do it a lot. Jews do it less. This embargo and this thing corresponds with Daniel, and then they have the Book of Revelations, their thing. But the Rambam says that Jew does not do it so much because we just don't know. In other words, when Mashiach comes, we'll be able to go to Mafreya and say, oh, now I understand. But until Mashiach comes, he says, your avodah is to be a maimon, and be as Mashiach, but say, I don't know exactly.
He did.
That date passed also. After he says, after he gives a long arichas, how forbidden it is, he doesn't say, but you know, I heard my father.
So many people have given a.
The end of Daniel tells you exactly when Mashiach comes. Exactly. Gives you a formula. And the different Mefarshim try to interpret the formula, and the Ramban comes up with something in the 1200s, and the Abarbanel in the 1500s, and the Malbim, I think, was the last Jewish commentator. He had 1920, came up with the 1920. And the emphasis, it's important to know, none of these commentaries are wrong, because all of these dates were potential dates. Nevuos are given in an obscure, open-ended way, because Hashem is allowing different ways it could be Mekoyim if the generation is Roy. That's a very important point. Meaning, if Sadri Gain was not schlugged up, Rashi was not schlugged up, the Nevuah was given that it could mean 1200, it could mean 1500, it could mean 1800, it could be 1900. And then even later, depending on how we're Zaycha. Hashem B'davka wanted to give us a chance to access the Geula in all of these different ways.
The 48 Nevi'im in Megillah, I remember reading that Rashi only knew 46 of them, and they had a machlekes of that the last two. Were those 48 Nevi'im the ones that we had, or of all time, which didn't?
No, those are the ones that are mentioned in Nach, Nevi'im and Ketubim. Rashi, the Gemara says, the numbers that we had 1,200,000.
Yeah.
So you have to understand that because Nevuah was a gift, not every Navi was given a big message. I mean, for example, when Shaul loses his donkeys, he says, he goes to Shmuel to ask him where his donkeys are. Let's go to the Navi. So there were Navi.
Yeah.
Their job basically was they were lost in town services. It was a job. Not every Navi, now you had to be a tzaddik to have that job, but not every Navi was given messages from Hashem.
So my question was, like, there's a bunch of, like, not just the building, there's a bunch of different books, and they selected which ones are the Iker.
Right.
But, I mean, that would imply that there were some who could have been at the status, but the Amshikinis just decided not to.
That's correct. In fact, some of the books that are in the Tanakh, there was a machlokas whether to include them. At some point, the Yecheskel almost didn't make it, because there are things in Yecheskel that on their surface contradict the Torah. And Chazal had to.
So we just have this part tradition now.
Oh, so you're asking where are these other books?
Or more like we just hold it as a tradition. These are the VM, and the others are just.
That's correct. That's correct. Either now again, it could either mean that their message has no eternal value, even if they were Nevi'im, or it could mean that they were certified as not being real Nevi'im. Some of them are in the Apocrypha. We actually have some of these books, but they're called Apocryphal books, which Chazal calls Sfarim Chisoni, Ben Sira. In fact, some of the books are considered to be good books. Ben Sira is a good book of Musar that Chazal use, but it's a book of Musar, it's not a book of prophecy, and therefore it was not included. It was not with Ruach HaKodesh. Okay. Other books were considered to be heretical, so excluded for different reasons.
Okay.